Okay, so this is Bio 231, the hybrid class, and it's Monday, September 14th. And you took a test last time, right? You took a test last time. I've got those graded after class. If you want to look over your test, you're welcome to come and look at your Scantron and make sure it's graded correctly. The grades are in Blackboard. If you didn't look over your practicum, I think you looked over your practicum already, but if you didn't, you didn't. You can look over those after class as well. I've got all of them there for you to look over. But today we're going to cover chapter 6, the beginning chapter on skeletal tissue. We've talked a couple of things already in lab, but we need to cover just a couple more things in this chapter. Maybe move on to axial skeleton. I'm not really sure if we will get there today or not. So before I get started, anybody have any questions at all? Any questions? No? Okay. So after class, you can look at your tests and the practicum. All right. So we're going to start the skeletal system. The components, the things that make up the skeletal system would be cartilage, bone, as well as some dense regular connective tissue we call ligaments. And a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. There is not much difference between a ligament and a tendon in terms of its microscopic structure. Right, it's both dense, regular connective tissue, which is the strongest kind of connective tissue. It's just that a ligament connects a bone to a bone, and a tendon connects a bone to a muscle. Yeah, it's actually a better way of saying it. It connects a muscle to a bone because it's a muscle that pulls on a bone via a tendon. But ligaments just stabilize the association of bones to each other. Right, so those are the three things that make up the skeletal system. The functions of the skeletal system, of course, is support is very important. Bone is rigid and strong. It can bear a lot of weight, and so it supports our body. Cartilage can bear some weight. It's not quite as strong as bone, but the advantage is that cartilage does have a certain shape. It provides shapes in our body, but cartilage is very light, so that's really nice. If all the cartilage in our body was bone, we'd have to eat a lot more every day to power our bodies. You'd have to develop a lot more muscle to carry all that extra weight around. So cartilage has a nice advantage. And also, cartilage is flexible. So certain parts of your body that you want to have it, the ability to deform and then go back to its original shape, then cartilage is good for that as well. Another important function of cartilage is that a lot of bones in your body were first modeled and positioned out of cartilage. And then that cartilage model filled in and became a bone later on. So cartilage can act like a stencil or a template for where bones should be and in that part of your body and in that kind of shape. Another important function of bone is for protection. Okay, your brain is protected by this armor plating called the cranium, the skull, right? So that protects your brain because the brain, for instance, is very soft tissue and it just can't stand up to any kind of trauma. So also the rib cage protects your heart and your lungs, for instance, and vertebral column protects, of course, the spinal cord. So these are all important functions of bone. Another important function of the skeletal system is motion or movement. So bones can move with respect to each other because sometimes a muscle attaches to a bone via a tendon. And a muscle will connect to two different bones. And when that muscle contracts, these two bones get pulled more closely together. And bones come together at joints. And so when a muscle contracts, it causes some kind of angulation within that joint, bringing these bones closer together. And another couple real important functions of bone is that bones are a storage area for calcium ions and inorganic phosphate or a phosphate. These are both important ions in your body. And so y'all probably knew before you took anatomy class that in order to have a nice strong bone, you need to have calcium in there. Okay? But what's even more important in a class like this, in a physiology class, is that you'll learn that there are going to be many important places where you need calcium and important functions that calcium gives your body. For instance, muscle contraction. Muscle can't even contract without the right calcium levels. Your heart won't contract, nerves can't conduct electrical impulses, information can't be transferred from one part of your body to the other without calcium. And probably the least significant place that you need to have calcium is in your bones. Right? But, of course, without proper level of calcium in your bones, they'll become brittle. So you need to have a lot of calcium to perform all these different functions. And bones will also store fat in the medullary cavities within bones. And fat is just a nice storage form of energy in your body, a nice efficient way of storing energy. And then lastly, bones are important because in some marrow cavities of bones, right, not all, but in some, we have red bone marrow. And red bone marrow is important because it's what we call a hematopoietic tissue. That's where red blood cells are actually produced. And when we were talking about blood in here, did I mention how many red blood cells in your body die every second? A lot. This is true. Maybe I forgot to mention it when we talked about blood connective tissue. Yeah, I did. It was millions, right? Maybe as many as 2 to 3 million red blood cells die every second in your body because they don't have room for a nucleus anymore, so they can't repair themselves, so they just die. So this hematopoietic tissue is very active. It has to be making how many red blood cells every second? Yeah, 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second so that you don't become anemic. So that is a very important function of bones as well, is that it produces red blood cells. All right, so here's a question. What's a hematopoietic tissue? It's a tissue that does what for us? It makes red blood cells, right, so we don't become anemic. And in particular, bone is a hematopoietic tissue, and the subdivision would be what? Red bone marrow. Okay. The kinds of cartilage that we have, this is just a little bit of a review from histology. Remember, there's hyaline cartilage, elastic cartilage, and the toughest one, fibrocartilage. Hyaline cartilage is where we find in the nose. It covers the ends of bones that form articulations. It forms the costal cartilages of our rib cage, and so our rib cage can change its shape pretty easily because of that cartilage. And also the larynx and trachea, that's part of your windpipe, right? Your lower airway for breathing has hyaline cartilage in it as well. So it means the shape of these structures without giving a lot of weight to your body. Elastic cartilage, you should probably remember what that looks like. It has a few fibers in it, highly branched, and we find elastic cartilage in the epiglottis in the ear. Right, so if you deform your ear and let it go, it just goes back to its original location because there's elastic tissue in there. And the same thing for the epiglottis. The epiglottis is associated with the larynx and pretty close to the trachea. It's right at the entrance to an airway, and the epiglottis should bend and cover the airway when you swallow something. Right, and when you're done swallowing, the epiglottis springs back into its original location, and then you can start to breathe again because it's really terrible to not be able to breathe, right? So that epiglottis has got to flop open again. That's elastic cartilage. All right, fibrocartilage is the toughest. It has a lot of fiber in it. That's the strongest fiber. What's the strongest fiber you're aware of? There are three fibers. There are three kinds of fibers. Okay. Does anybody know a fiber type? Collagen is one. Reticular is another. And elastic, these three. Which one is the strongest? Collagen. Yeah, collagen. So fibrocartilage has a lot of collagen in it, so it's really tough. It resists compression and tension. And so it makes the intervertebral discs that protect the vertebral bodies. And there's also the menisci of the knee that prevent compression of the femur into the tibia. Okay, so these are fibrocartilages. Of course, that doesn't mean that they're not vulnerable to damage. You can overstress them and they can rip and cause nasty problems, but generally they're pretty tough because they have collagen in them. Okay, so I think we have a slide right here that shows us the bones of the skeleton and various places where we have the cartilage that I was talking about, hyaline cartilage, right, in joints, for instance, and the nose, fibrocartilage in the knee menisci, right, and the intervertebral discs, and elastic cartilage in the ear, but I can't see the epiglottis because it's behind the mandible over here. All right, so these are some places where you find the different kinds of cartilages. Well, bones, different bones have different shapes, and we like to classify bones by their shape. So, for instance, if a bone is very thin in one dimension, we call it a flat bone, right, because it's flat. You know, we should probably call it squamous, but flat works, all right? So flat bone, a good example would be the sternum. Some bones are really long in one dimension and equal in the other two dimensions, and so we call that a long bone. Some long bones can be really, really short, but if one dimension is long compared to the other two, then we just call it a long bone. Like a bone that's in the tip of your little finger. That's a really short bone, but it's still long in one dimension, so that's a long bone, even though it's tiny. Even though it's a tiny bone, it's still a long bone. All right. Other bones kind of have just a funny shape to them. We call them short bones, like the bones that make up the wrist bones. A wrist bone is what we call a carpal. And they've got specific names depending on what kind of carpal it is. And then there are some bones with bumps all over them, with different processes sticking out of them. And these are what we call irregular. A really good example of an irregular bone is a vertebrae. All right, so here's a vertebrae right here. So be able to classify a couple bones by their shape. All right, we went over this in lab, the different parts of a long bone, the histology of it. But I'll just review real quick. It's good to have a model in your mind of what a typical long bone is made out of. So the ends of a long bone are what we call the epiphyses. So here's a proximal epiphysis, and down here is the distal epiphysis. And the part in between is what we call the shaft, but a more proper term would be the diaphysis of a long bone. So you got the two epiphyses and a diaphysis. Right? And when you look at this long bone right here, notice that there are two different kinds of bone. We see some bone that's very solid. It doesn't have any holes in it whatsoever. And then there's another kind of bone that has holes all over the place in it. So this is what we call compact bone, right? The one without any holes. Compact bone, the one that has all these holes, is what we call spongy bone because it looks like a sponge. And notice that this compact bone we find everywhere right on the surface of the bone. Even the epiphyses have compact bone. A thinner layer, but nonetheless, it's still there. And an organ generally has at least two areas. There's a superficial area for an organ, right? We call that the cortex. And then there's a deeper region. Anybody remember what the deeper region of an organ is called? That's the, maybe I didn't mention it, that's the medulla, right? So the cortex is on the outside, the medulla is the deep part. So bones are the same way. There's a cortex. So here I can see the cortex of this bone. What kind of bone actually makes up the cortex? What does it look like to you? Does it look spongy or compact? It's compact. So compact bone and cortical bone are used synonymously and interchangeably, right? Cortical, because it's on the surface, or compact, really pretty much are the same thing. Okay. The spongy bone is where it's deep. So it also goes by the name of medullary bone. Medullary bone or spongy bone, exactly the same kind of terms. One just has more of a spatial connotation to it. Medullary means deeper. There are other terms for spongy bone. Sometimes we call it trabecular bone because of all the lattice nature, all these little bony plates right here. We call those trabeculi. So trabecular bone, medullary bone, spongy bone are the same. As a matter of fact, there's even another name for medullary bone, and that's called cancellous. Cancellous bone, trabecular, medullary bone is all the same kind of thing that we see right here. Okay, there's a membrane that surrounds every bone in your body. What's that membrane that surrounds the bone on the outside? That's the periosteum. And there is a corresponding membrane that lines every interior surface of a bone. That is the endosteum, right? So this is a little bit of a review. Here is that big cavity in the medulla, so we call that the medullary cavity. Medullary cavity can be filled with two different kinds of substances, either yellow bone marrow, like what I see here, or red bone marrow, right? And I don't see that in this diagram. All right. So here I can see the trabeculae. And then up over here, I see the compact bone. So this is just a nice slice, a wedge taken out of a bone. All right. So this is the medullary bone. Here's the cortical bone. And what about these circles right here? Can you remember what these things were called? Oh, what happened? Yeah, those are osteans. I thought I had a picture of an ostean someplace. Ah, here it is. Okay. So here is a better magnification of what kind of bone does this look like here? Spongy or compact? It's compact bone. So the structural and functional unit of compact bone is the osteon, right? Which is a system of tubes, tube with inside tubes. So let's zoom into this region nicely right here. All right, so these circular structures are what we call lamellae. And that gives bone a lot of resistance to compression. It's almost impossible to compress a tube. And bone is not just a tube, it's what? It's a tube within a tube within a tube, and all of these tubes, and then what do you have surrounding all of these tubes right here? You even have more tubes on the outside. These inner tubes are what we call concentric lamellae. The ones way out in the cortex over here, these are what we call circumferential. But nonetheless, these resist compression. That's why bones just don't compress unless you really apply a tremendous amount of force. But you can also see on this diagram that there's more than just matrix in bone. There are a lot of blood vessels. Look at all these blood vessels right here. This one running through an osteon. This is what we call a haversian canal. All right, and these canals that are transverse to the long axis of the bone, these are what we call perforating canals, right? Or Volkmann's canals. So you got the central canals or haversian canal versus the Volkmann's canals, which are perforating, they're transverse. And they carry nerves and blood. All right, so when you fracture a bone, what's one bad thing that happens when you fracture a bone? That's not good for you, it's detrimental. Yeah, these blood vessels are going to break, and you're going to hemorrhage as a result of that. And that could be a massive hemorrhage if it's a big bone, like a hip bone or a femur or something. It could be life-threatening. But if you don't die from a hemorrhage, what's the good thing about having all these blood vessels in a bone? It will repair itself relatively rapidly compared to other parts of your body, all right, just within weeks, because it can bring in oxygen and nutrients and calcium, and the bone can be repaired as a result of that. All right, so it's kind of a double-edged sword. One good thing, one bad thing. But remember, bone is a living tissue. So that means if it's alive, what does it have to have? What's the basic building block of life? It's a cell. So there are living cells. And what do we call those cells? Osteocytes. And the osteocytes live in these little lagoons, right, or little pits in the bone matrix that we call lacunae. All right, so here I can see a nice osteocyte in a lacunae. And these osteocytes can get nourishment from the capillaries in the central canal because material can diffuse through these tiny, tiny little passageways in the bone matrix. They're not really fractures or anything abnormal. They really belong there. And these are what we call canaliculi. So oxygen can diffuse and get to all of these cells. Glucose can get to these cells. Calcium can get to all of these cells via the canaliculi. It's a very important passageway. Okay. So the structural and functional unit of compact bone is what we call the osteon, right? And that's really easy to see underneath a microscope. Okay. So I think I talked about all of these things. Yeah. Oh, one last thing. Spongy bone in a flat bone, like a cranial bone, sometimes we call that diploid. And where was that picture of diploid? Okay, right here. So here's a nice flat bone. And this spongy bone in a cranial bone, that's what we call diploid as well. Okay. Okay, what about the chemical composition of bones? There are two kinds. of chemicals that we find in bones. We can characterize them as either being organic or inorganic. All right? Organic just means that there's going to have some kind of carbon molecule associated with it. Inorganic means that it's not going to have a carbon molecule, but it could have something like calcium or iron or phosphorus associated with it. So the organic component of bone, of course, we have some living things, which are cells, right? And so we've got three major kinds of cells in bone. In mature bone, like we've seen, there is something called an osteocyte. That maintains healthy bone. But there are also two other kinds of cells. There is a cell that can build bone, and that's called an osteoblast. A blast is a bone builder. All right? And the third kind of cell is called an osteoclast that breaks bone down. So every 5 years, you have a new skeleton. You're completely remodeling your skeleton because you're doing different activities that you're doing now compared to 5 years ago. And your skeleton is adjusting to that change in lifestyle. And the calcium is turning over. So bones are continually being broken down by what kind of cell? Osteoclasts. And then they're being rebuilt in the right position, in the right location, by osteoblasts. Okay. So what can you tell me about the relationship between osteoblasts and osteoclasts? What is their action to each other? Okay, reciprocating is kind of interesting way of thinking about it, right? They're actually opposite to each other, right? So one breaks bone down, the other builds it up. But a really nice way of talking about the opposite nature is that these two cells are antagonistic to each other. Okay, antagonism. Now, in your impression of antagonism, is it a good thing or a bad thing? It's a bad thing. You don't like to be around antagonistic people unless it's really funny for some reason, but generally you don't like to be around, you don't like to be roasted all day long, right? Okay. But in terms of control systems, antagonism is extremely important because it provides for precise control and balance. Precise control and balance are the key terms. So, for instance, let's compare an item like your automobile. It's got antagonistic mechanisms, right? And I would like for you to tell me what two antagonistic mechanisms are, all right, that work together so you have precise control and balance of your car. Yeah, the brake pedal and the accelerator. You wouldn't think of driving your car without having both of those working together, right? And all important functions in your body, if they're really important and you need to have control of them, they're controlled by two mechanisms that are antagonistic to each other. Okay. And that's true for bone as well. In order to have the proper skeleton, these two types of cells have to be working in just the right kind of way so that your bones are maintained perfectly. But guess what? As we get older, the balance between these two different cells starts to change, and one gets to be a little bit more active than the other. Guess which one it is? It gets to be a little bit more active. The osteoclasts, right? So as we get older, our bones start to break down a little bit and they get brittle. And that's a disease process. What do we call that? Osteoporosis. And did I talk about this in lab? Yeah? Yeah? No? Maybe?
A little bit?
Okay. Well, osteoporosis, all right, is an imbalance of this inherent antagonistic mechanism. And it's pretty interesting to me because it's very rare to have a disease process that's going to affect everybody in a population. Like, for instance, when the swine flu is going around, are we all going to come down with swine flu? No. And why is it that we all don't come down with this nasty cold that was going around this summer, or the swine flu that's going to come around? Why is it that we all don't come down with it? Yeah, we all have different immune systems. That's very true, because we're all different. Right, if you look around the room, right, you don't see another you sitting anywhere, right? We're a diverse population, and that's the purpose of diversity in a population, is it confers a lot of strength to the population. But osteoporosis is one of these funny diseases that will affect everybody if you're lucky enough to live long enough, right? So it's really kind of strange. It affects women a little bit sooner and a little bit more severely because if you compare males versus females, who generally has a slighter bone structure? Who has less bone in their body? Is it females or males? Yeah, females a little bit slighter in skeletal structure. So if they lose a little bit of bone, it becomes clinically significant to them at an earlier age compared to males. But even if you're a male, you will lose bone mass as you get older. Okay, and when you lose bone mass, then they become brittle, susceptible to fracture. So how is it you can protect yourself from osteoporosis? Exercise is one thing. Somebody said calcium, and that's true. I kind of lump calcium in with the diet part of protecting yourself. So it's one reason why people hate to take a physiology or anatomy class, because the way that you can help your body, fix your body, is two general ways that always works is what? Diet and exercise. The two things that, you know, nobody really likes to do. But diet because you need calcium, and diet because you need proper vitamins like vitamin D, and exercise because when you exercise a bone, how does a bone respond? Just like a muscle, right? It gets bigger and stronger too, and calcium gets deposited. And that's really important for women because it's easy for women to develop bone mass premenopausally. It gets more difficult postmenopausally. So if you're a woman with a very thin bone structure and you want to protect yourself, diet and exercise before menopause. That will do the most good for you. Okay. So, the other thing, the other organic component in bone that's really important is collagen, right? It gives the bone a little flexibility, but tensile strength, meaning what? That you can't pull a bone because of collagen. And the other thing is that because there's collagen in there, you can't twist the bone. It's very, very rigid. So one of the reasons why you can't do this is because of the arrangement of collagen fibers. So here we see basically an osteon that's been everything, all the layers have been reflected off of it, so we can see three main layers right here. And in every lamella, we can see the collagen fibers. And what's the orientation of these collagen fibers? Are they all parallel to each other between layers? No, they form belts that are running perpendicular to each other. And so that gives a tremendous amount of strength for twisting, which is what we call torsion, and it resists stretching because collagen just doesn't stretch. Okay. And collagen is an organic compound. It's basically a protein, right? It's made out of amino acids. So that's an organic kind of compound. All right. So the inorganic components are mineral salts, which we call hydroxyapatites, and they're made from both calcium and phosphate. You should just be aware of that. Probably you know about calcium already. And they're put together in different kind of formulas. You don't have to know the chemical formulas for this, but if you're interested to know what hydroxyapatite is, right here is the formula. You get 10 calciums for every 6 inorganic phosphates and a couple hydroxyl groups. This is an inorganic compound. Okay? And what this does for bones is that it doesn't resist stretching, okay, because it would fracture and it would break very easily. It doesn't resist twisting. But what this compound does, it resists compression, right? So this adds another dimension of strength to a bone. So the bone can't stretch because why? Why can't the bone stretch? Because of collagen, that's right. A bone doesn't twist because it has collagen, and a bone doesn't compress because it has the hydroxyapatite or calcium in it, right? So if a bone was only made out of collagen fibers, if you have a nice strong fiber and you pull really hard, you can't stretch it, but can you compress a fiber? Yeah, without any force whatsoever, right? And so that's why calcium is in bone, to resist compression. All right, so try to remember, you got the organic and inorganic, and what dimensions of strength does that give a bone? You've got twisting, you got tension, and you got compression. Okay. Okay. So we talked about this already. One thing we haven't talked about is bone formation and growth. Okay, maybe talk just a little bit about this, but not too much. In lab. Basically, there are two kinds of processes that can build bone. And they're under the term of ossification or osteogenesis, right? The building of bone. And anytime, of course, you hear this term osteo, you should think of bone, yeah, right? So osteogenesis is building bone. All right, so the two kinds of ways that bones can be made is the first one, intramembranous ossification. Intramembranous means that bone is going to develop from a membrane, okay, which is what? Kind of a flat structure. So you would guess that all bones that are kind of flat in their basic shape are going to develop from intramembranous ossification. Where do you have a lot of flat bones? In your skull. So a lot of bones of the skull, as a matter of fact, all bones of the skull develop from intramembranous ossification, right? And then the membranes become harder and harder and harder as they ossify, right? And those cells are what we call osteoblasts that lay down the matrix. Sometimes we call that matrix osteoid, is the material that resists compression. Okay. At birth, it's really fortunate that all the flat bones of our cranium are not completely formed. There's large spaces between them because when we're born, the skull actually has to squish out of shape to get through the birth canal. Right? So you couldn't even be born unless your skull can deform. And those membranes allow the skull to deform and then kind of pop back into the correct location. And those portions of the non-ossified skull, right, prenatally and even in the neonate, are what we call fontanelles. And I think there's two L's and an E sometimes. You can spell fontanelles a couple of different ways if you wanted to. Okay. More commonly, those fontanelles are called soft spots. Right, and I think maybe we did talk about this in lab because we did have that neonate skull in there, and you got four fontanelles you have to know. Maybe I can find a picture of the fontanelles right here. But more importantly, how long do those fontanelles last for?
2 years.
Yeah, 2 years. That's a really long time. I guess maybe I can see some of the fontanelles on this slide right here. There's one right up over here. This is the anterior fontanelle. And then there's one back over here, which is the posterior fontanelle. And there's one where the sphenoid is going to be. That's the sphenoidal fontanelle. And then there's one way back down over here behind the earlobe by the mastoid process. And so we call that the mastoidal or mastoid fontanelle. Right. Okay. Let me just go one slide more. No, I don't have a picture of a fontanelle anywhere. Okay. Okay. All right, so all bones of the skull are from intramembranous, and then one other bone too, and that's the clavicle, develops from intramembranous. All the rest develop from the next kind, which is endochondrial ossification. So endochondrial means that there's no membrane, but where the bone is going to develop is first made out of hyaline cartilage. The bone is modeled, it's going to act as a template for where the bone really should develop, and it's hyaline cartilage. Do you have a picture of what hyaline cartilage looks like in your mind? Right, it's got, what, chondrocytes and lacunae, and the matrix is just very translucent. It's not a very strong kind of cartilage, but it just gives the overall shape of where that bone should be. Okay, so this happens in stages. Endochondrial ossification happens in stages. There's first a primary ossification center. So, for instance, most of the bones in the rest of your skeleton are long bones. And so the primary ossification center is in the diaphysis, right? Mid-diaphysis. And the very center of the diaphysis forms a ring of ossification. We call that a bone collar formation, right? And that's done with what kind of cells? What produces?
Osteoblasts.
Ah, yeah, the osteoblasts. All right, so let's see, where is the osteoblast at? Ah, here we go. Okay, so here is a nice hyaline cartilage model of a long bone. This could be any number of long bones in your body. And then the primary ossification center, of course, this is what, just a section, remember, it goes all the way around the diaphysis. Those osteoblasts lay down osteoid, and the collar gets bigger and bigger and bigger. All right, and then there is a nutrient foramen that opens up. And we went over different landmarks in bones. And so what's a foramen? It's a hole. Yeah, it's a hole, passageway for something. And in particular, we call this a nutrient foramen because it's bringing a blood vessel into the medulla of this long bone, bringing what? Nutrients in. So we call it a nutrient hole or foramen, allowing this blood vessel to bring nutrients into the bone. And the osteoblasts lay more and more bone down in the diaphysis. Right? And as the diaphysis is almost completely formed, a secondary ossification center begins in both the proximal and distal epiphyses in the medulla. And the osteoblasts then start to lay down osteoid in this location. And then eventually, these two growth centers meet up. Right? And this area right here always remains cartilage, remains hyaline cartilage as the individual is developing until puberty. And that becomes a growth plate for bone length. So a bone will grow in length at this proximal epiphyseal growth plate and the distal epiphyseal growth plate right here. Right, so what can you tell me about the strength of this spongy bone and compact bone compared to this hyaline cartilage in the growth plate? Which is stronger? Yeah, the bone has got to be a lot stronger than the cartilage. So, as pre-pubertal individuals, this growth plate can be damaged very easily by torsion, by compression, even by tensioning that particular bone. And when it's damaged, then bone formation is going to be degraded and this bone won't reach its normally designed length as a result. All right, so people have to be concerned about protecting these growth plates for especially really rambunctious little boys. Okay, like people that like to go swinging really high and jump off of a swing or climb up to the top of a monkey bar and jump off or whatever, because that compression injury might damage that growth plate. And it might just damage one appendage and not the other, one leg and not the other leg. So what's going to happen? One leg is going to be stunted, right? And that's really unfortunate when that happens. Okay, because then you need some kind of prosthetic or orthotics to correct that imbalance in somebody's length of their legs. Okay. And this epiphyseal plate, when does the epiphyseal plate close over? After puberty, right? And that typically explains why, at least within a family, who's taller, men or the women? Men are taller because they don't reach puberty until later compared to women, right? So women mature a little bit more early in life, and so they're typically a little bit shorter because that's when these epiphyseal plates close over. Okay. Okay, appositional growth is growth of bone by addition of bone tissues to its surfaces. All right, it's growth from previously existing bone. Right, as opposed to interstitial growth, which is growth from a new growth center. So when a bone grows in diameter, let's go back to a diagram. How does a bone grow in diameter? Let's go back to maybe this figure right here. All right, remember, what's the membrane on the outside of the bone? Periosteum. The membrane on the inside is the endosteum. These typically have two different kinds of cells. In the periosteum, there are primarily osteoblasts. So what happens in the periosteum if there are osteoblasts there? Bone growth, right? So the bone is going to get larger in diameter. But in the endosteum, we have a different cell, the osteoclasts. So those osteoclasts are making sure that the bone doesn't become overly heavy or completely filled up. It maintains the medullary cavity, right? So that's what we call appositional bone growth. All right, from existing growth centers, appositional bone growth, and it's always going to be a balance between osteoclasts and osteoblasts. All right, and where we would find the two different kinds of cells, one in the periosteum and the other in the endosteum. Okay. Okay. Well, bone remodeling. This can take place, for instance, when you fracture a bone, but remodeling is something your bones are doing all the time because your bones are adjusting to your activity levels, just like all your muscles are adjusting to activity levels. And you could think of bone remodeling like, for instance, when you remodel your house. A lot of times when you remodel your house, you have to not just build on top of it, but you actually have to knock something down right before you can build it the way you want to build it. So in remodeling, there is a process where osteoclasts break down bone into little fragments and then remove the fragments, right? And then osteoblasts move in and deposit new bone matrix in that area of the bone that needs to become stronger and bigger. And this process is continually happening. Actually, more importantly, I think I would like you to know that what all of your bones are completely remodeled after how many years? After 5 years, right? So you got a complete new skeleton every 5 years. So it's a very active living tissue. All right, but if for whatever reason you do fracture a bone, right, how does it repair itself? Well, it's going to require remodeling, of course, which from that you should realize that after a bone is healed, if it heals properly, what's the strength of a bone after it's been broken, if it heals properly? It's even going to be stronger than original. Okay? So when you break a bone, there's hemorrhage because of all those blood vessels, right? And so a clot is going to form to stop the bleeding. And what's going to happen after that point is that some fibroblasts will move in to the blood clot. And what's the job of a fibroblast? What does it secrete? Like fibers of some kind, like collagen fibers. So fibroblasts are going to weave this network of fibers through the clot, and that's going to be something we call a callus. So the collagen is going to stabilize the fracture, right, to keep the bones from moving, because if the bones continue to move, then that's going to continue to lacerate blood vessels, and it's going to then potentiate the hemorrhage. Okay, so this callus is made out of collagen. And then chondrocytes move in and lay down some cartilage matrix. Right? So you can imagine that that stabilizes the fracture, but is that really strong? A callus is not really strong because it's just cartilage and collagen fibers. It's not as strong as bone. All right, so to protect a bone when it's healing, what do we like to do typically? To protect the callus so that it doesn't damage, so it doesn't hemorrhage anymore, so it doesn't break. Yeah, we like to cast, right, fractures at this point in time. Because if a callus is disrupted after about a week or so, then the bone is never going to heal the way that it should. So that's really important to mobilize that fracture with a cast, if at all possible. Right? Because the callus is important because osteoblasts enter the callus and deposit new bone matrix, new osteoid. And then if you don't disrupt the callus after about 4 weeks, you have new bone matrix and the bone is even stronger than it was before because there's even more bone in that location. So it's even stronger. But if a bone is fractured during that period again, then that bone will probably always have a weak point right there because the callus was damaged. So this is a relatively fast process, 4 to 6 weeks. And you can understand that because bone is what? Highly vascular. It's got a lot of blood vessels. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a really tough decision to make. Okay, revising fractures. Easy to do within the first week because you haven't damaged the callus, okay, irreversibly. So if the fracture hasn't been reduced properly, and they like to take x-rays to see how things are reforming properly, then a bone might have to be, you know, refractured to reduce the fracture to the proper location. So that's a difficult call. And then after that week's period, it even is more difficult to make that call. But if the benefits outweigh the risks of re-breaking that bone, then of course you would never consider doing that. So that's what medicine is all about. There's never really a right answer. It's just a good judgment call. Is you're trying to balance out what's more benefit for the patient. Okay, how can you optimize a certain kind of outcome? Okay, so that's it for this chapter. right? Skeletal tissue. So make sure you know the osteon. What is the structural and functional unit of compact bone called? So if you're going to have a picture in your mind of compact bone, what should it be? In just in one word, you could say the osteon, right? And the osteon has got the central canal with blood vessels, got perforating canals, it's got all the lamellae, it's got lacunae with osteocytes in there. What's connecting the different lacunae so that the osteocytes can get oxygen? The canaliculi, right? So all of that stuff goes into your picture and understanding of an osteon. So, right, structural and functional unit, you could say very simply, but it should conjure up, you know, a lot of images. Haversian system or osteon. Most people like osteon a lot more than haversian system. Probably haversian system is kind of going out the window, is my guess. Okay. It was just named after somebody who described it. And in science, we're getting farther and farther away of naming processes and structures after people's names that discovered it. I don't know. That's too bad, probably. It's kind of fun to know something about the history and the names associated with who did what. Okay, any questions on skeletal tissues? What's a bone-to-bone connection called? Ligament. What's a muscle-to-bone connection called? Yeah, tendon. Okay, what are the three kinds of cartilages? Yeah. All at one time. Multiplex. Fibrous, hyaline, and elastic. Right. All right, so we're going to move on to the next chapter. We talked about some of this stuff in lab already, like all of the landmarks, right? You just had to know that before you could start looking at bones. Otherwise, it was just a waste of time. Okay, the Tuesday quiz. Oh, what did I say? What did I say for a quiz?
The diamond.
Yeah?
I say it was the diamond. No, are you talking about online? The online.
Oh, the online, okay, the Tuesday night quiz. It's going to, you know, they're always going to focus on the review questions, the internet review questions. I think it's just, six and seven. Yeah, I think it's just six and seven. But that should be really clear to see from the web. I could, you know, if I open that up, it would say right at the beginning, because the very first page of a week is the objectives, and it tells you what the reading is and what chapters exactly. Okay, and then later on, like the fourth page or fifth page, it's the online questions. Okay, so far I've pretty much just been lifting the online questions right off the internet and putting them into the quiz. Okay, so if you got time to look at those online questions, which it's kind of painless to look at those over a number of times. Right, the online quiz potentially is pretty easy to do. Okay. All right. So let's find some slides to look at. Well, that looks good. Axial skeleton. All right. So here's an overall skeleton. It's got axial skeleton in green. And it has another skeleton in yellow. All right, so the whole skeleton can be divided into these two groups, axial versus appendicular. Yeah, appendicular. All right, so the axial skeleton is the skull, the vertebral column, including the sacrum and the coccyx right here, as well as the rib cage and the sternum in the front, right? So it's the whole thoracic cage. Actually, that's a better way of saying it, thoracic cage, vertebral column, and skull. That's the axial skeleton. So that's kind of what we're responsible for in this chapter. And then the next chapter is what? The appendicular skeleton, the bones of your appendages. All right. So here we have really good skull model. And this might be an exam figure. I don't know. Does anybody have your exam figures with you? Is this an exam figure?
Mm-hmm.
Probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I see the skeleton is. How about next page? Is next page on there?
Yeah.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. This is figure 7.2A. All right, so all of these things here are really good to know. Right, make sure you know all the bones as well as the foramina and other aspects on this particular figure. All right. Well, when you have the skull, in your mind, probably it would be helpful to organize it into two main categories of bones. There are bones that surround the brain. Guess what we call those? Those are cranial bones. And then there are bones that make up the face. And those are what we call facial bones. So try to put bones into those two main categories. All right, so facial bones, for instance. Here's a good one. This is the mandible. Okay, and as a matter of fact, this is the only bone in the skull that moves. Everything else is just kind of stationary. And it moves in a lot of ways. We're going to talk about motion, but it can depress, right? And it can elevate. What else can it do? Be careful, don't chip a tooth. It can protract, right? You can jut your mandible out, and you can also retract. So that's four ways the mandible can move, but it can also slide to the left and slide to the right. So that's a really complicated kind of motion. So it's not uncommon for people to develop difficulty with that joint because it's a very complicated kind of joint. That's called the temporomandibular joint. So from that name, you should probably be able to figure out what bone of the skull the mandible articulates with. Temporomandibular means that it's the mandible articulates with the temporal bone, right? So even if you don't have a picture, just by knowing a little bit of nomenclature, you should be able probably to figure that out. All right, so mandible or lower jawbone has got teeth in it, and it's a special kind of joint, right? So sometimes this little socket that a tooth is in, we call that an alveolus. And the top margin of an alveolus, we just call that the alveolar margin of the mandible. Here is a nice foramen in the mandible. We call that the mental foramen for the passageway for blood vessels and nerves. All right, we're going to see another important one in the mandible in just a little bit. Okay, then the upper jawbone is the maxilla. That's another facial bone. Another facial bone would be the nasal bones. Okay, another facial bone is one that makes part of the nasal septum. And a septum is a wall that separates one big cavity into a couple smaller cavities. So this one here, the inferior part of the nasal septum is made out of the vomer, and the superior part is made with the ethmoid bone. But the ethmoid bone is not really a facial bone because it also makes up part of the bones that hold the brain in position. Right, so ethmoid is kind of interesting. It's really considered a cranial bone as a result of that. Your cheekbone is the zygomatic bone. You got two of those. And then there's one bone that goes all the way across. It's a cranial bone. It starts here, makes even the posterior part of the orbit, which is this socket that your eyeball fits in. Right, that's an orbital cavity. And this bone is the sphenoid, and it kind of looks like a butterfly. It's got a lot of pieces to it. We'll look at that some. Okay, bone in the most anterior part of the cranium and superior, that's the frontal bone. We can see some supraorbital foramina. Sometimes they're not completely formed. They just form a little notch. So in that case, we would call it the what? Supraorbital notch. Yeah. So who knows who's got what? It's highly variable. And then this is the supraorbital margin. That's just the edge of the orbit on the frontal bone. This little protuberance right here is called the glabella between the orbits on the frontal bone. What else can we say? Infraorbital foramen. Okay. Then we have some large spaces on the posterior or passageways. We have the inferior orbital fissure and the superior orbital fissure. These are in the sphenoid bone. And I can't see it. Oh, yeah, we can. I can't see it, but it's right here. This is the optic canal for the optic nerve to enter the brain. Where does this optic nerve come from? It's coming from your eyes, right? In particular, the retina. This allows vision, right? So it enters through this little foramen right here. Okay, then right behind the frontal bone, you've got the parietal bone. Ah, a couple other little bones. All right, there are little shelves inside the nasal cavity. We call these conchae, or sometimes we call them turbinates as well, nasal conchae. There are three sets. This is the inferior, here's the middle, and the superior we can't really see. But these help air condition air as you're breathing it into your lungs. So if the air is really hot, guess what they do? They cool it down so you don't singe your lungs. Or if it's freezing cold outside, they warm it up so you don't freeze your lungs. And if it's really dry, they help humidify the air. So they do a lot of air conditioning. And they also help filter out little dust particles, right? So that your lungs don't fill up with microscopic junk and then you can't breathe, right? So they do a lot of work, just filtering or air conditioning the air. There's another little bone, which is the thinnest and daintiest bone, the lacrimal bone. And there's a tear duct that kind of goes from your orbit into your nasal cavity. Right? Sometimes we call that the lacrimal fossa. And that's why when you're teary-eyed, your nose is also running because tears run into your nose via that little passageway right there. All right, as well as maybe out of your eyelids. Okay, so that's a really good picture to know. You should also know sutures. These are the immovable joints in the skull. Sagittal suture is between the parietal bones. The lambdoidal suture is between the parietal and the occipital bone. And there's a couple others, which I can't see on this slide right here, which I'll show you on the next slide. And there are a couple lines and crests. Right? What's the function of this external occipital crest right here? Okay. What's the function of this inferior nuchal line right here? Or what's the function of this superior nuchal line? Now, a line and a crest is a kind of process. What's the function of any process? Without even thinking, you should say muscle attachment. Yeah, it's going to connect to a muscle. So that's the function of this inferior nuchal line, right? And even this mastoid process. What's the function of the mastoid process? Muscle attachment. Anytime you see process, you should immediately think muscle attachment. So a muscle is going to be pulling on that part of the bone, attached to the bone right there. So the bone is being stressed in that location. So how is the bone going to respond when it's being pulled and stressed at that one little location? It's going to get bigger and stronger, right, to put up with that stress. And so, therefore, it becomes a raised, rough area. All right, so you can see a couple sutures here. We can see some more sutures. I don't see the sagittal suture, but you know where it is. Here is the coronal, I suppose you could say frontal suture. This one in the flat side of your head, we call that the squamosal suture. Right, because the temporal bone in this region right here is very flat, so we call this the squamosal region or the squamous region of the temporal bone. Occipital is way posterior, and the temporal bone, you see, has a lot of nice features to it. This big bony process, mastoid process, you see it's massive. So what can you tell me? What kind of muscle is attaching to this process? Big, strong muscle. It's holding up your head so you don't break your neck. Right, so it's got to be really big and strong. Here's a styloid process. You think you have a big, huge, massive muscle attached to this one? Probably not, because it would break right off. These muscles are more delicate. They do a finer job, but just as important, but for articulation and swallowing and things like that. But you don't need big, strong, massive muscles. You just need to have muscles with really fine control. Here is a hole. We call that the external auditory meatus. That's so that sound pressure can enter a part of your ear so that you can hear things. All right, so that's a temporal bone, which also includes this, the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. Why do we call this the zygomatic process? Because it connects to the zygomatic bone, right? That's a perfect answer. So here's the zygomatic bone. Here's a process on the zygomatic bone. What do you think the name of this process is of the zygomatic bone? It's not labeled, but it is the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. So the temporal process of the zygomatic bone plus the zygomatic process of the temporal bone make the zygomatic arch. Yeah, it makes the zygomatic arch. So look in your textbook. The textbook got that wrong for I don't know how many months or year or so. Even the same edition. Some books have it wrong, some books have it right. Okay. You can also see that lambdoidal suture once again over here. Now you can see the lacrimal bone, very nice. And here is the maxilla. And tell me what the name of this process of the maxilla is. Okay. It's the maxilla, and it is touching what bone? The frontal bone. So how do we name this process? Not after the bone that it's on, but after the bone it connects to. So this is the frontal process of the maxilla. Yeah. Okay. And, oh, look at this. What bone is this right here? This is the zygomatic bone. So guess what the name of this process of the zygomatic bone is? It's touching the frontal bone, so that's the frontal process of the zygomatic bone. Okay. For some reason, that's really hard. That nomenclature is really hard for some students to see. All right, but once you see it, it becomes really easy. So if you're not catching on how we're naming these different processes, yeah, talk to me or other students in lab. Okay. All right, but if I give you this exam figure, of course, you don't have to tell me that process or this one here because why? It's not labeled on this diagram, right? I'm just trying to teach you a little bit of nomenclature. All right. Well, what else do we know? Well, there are some big cavities inside some bones, cranial bones. Like, for instance, here's the frontal bone. And so this big cavity we call the frontal sinus, right? And here's a big cavity in the sphenoid bone. So we call that the sphenoid sinus. There is a big cavity within the maxilla. Those would be the maxillary sinuses. And there's cavities in the ethmoid bone, which I can't show you here because we're not looking inside of it. So there are ethmoid sinuses. These are all paranasal sinuses. They're filled with lymphatic tissue, which fights infection because we're breathing in pathogens all the time. So these are important to help protect us from getting the flu and colds and all that kind of stuff. Okay. But what I do see here, I see a nasal bone, but I see the nasal septum. You can see the superior part is made out of the ethmoid bone, and the inferior part is blade-like bone. That's the vomer. And what are the two bones that make the roof of the mouth? Here's the palatine, which really kind of looks like an L if we were to isolate it. And then this is the horizontal, or the palatine process of the maxilla, because it touches the palatine bone. Okay. All right, so this is, I don't think that's an exam figure. That's nice to know. All right, now, I don't know if this is an exam figure, but it is. Okay, I'm glad, because this is important for lab. Because I do want you to know all of these foramina. All right, so this will be a quiz in lab one of these days. I guess maybe not next time, because did I say this was going to be a quiz?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah. Well, before you go, if we got time, I'll draw it out. No?
You already did it.
You did it already?
No, you gave it out.
It wasn't a full thing, but
you showed us the way that you would want us to draw it without a whole bunch of.
Okay. What are you going to have for a quiz on Wednesday? This is it. This is it. Okay, good. Okay, that's for this coming Wednesday.
Yes.
Good. Okay. Well, if you want to go over that before, well, I was hoping so. All right. If you want to go over that, okay, how to draw it before we leave, I can probably do it in just a couple minutes, right? So you should be able to draw it. All right. But you got what? The olfactory foramina. So let's take it from anterior to posterior real quick. Olfactory foramina for olfactory nerves to enter the nasal cavity. What's the function of an olfactory nerve? Smell, that's right. Sense odors. Okay, then optic canal. All right, then there's a little round one here. Rotundum, and then an oval-shaped one, ovale, and then a little tiny, tiny one, spinosum. And then there's like a little ridge, and you go over that ridge, and you get down into this valley that is forms a little lake or puddle down there. That's foramen lacerum. Okay, and then right about here is where you have your ear, right? So you got the external auditory meatus right here. And then corresponding on the inside, that's the internal acoustic meatus. This region of the temporal bone is called the petrous region. A lot of apparatus in here for hearing as well as equilibrium. So when we get into the senses chapter, we'll look at the inner ear. So the whole inner ear is in this region. Really important. And then there's a huge hole right here, jugular foramen, and even a huger hole, of course, foramen magnum. And in between the jugular and foramen magnum, there is the hypoglossal canal, right? So make sure you can kind of draw this and show the relationship of these different foramina on Wednesday. Yeah.
So we're
going to
draw
some scraps? No, you're going to draw. I'll show you before you guys leave. All right. Okay. Huh? I showed you already, but I'll show you again if you want. All right. Depends if we get kicked out of here. Sometimes we have a class right afterwards, sometimes not. All right. But when you're in lab, I want you to take the calvarium off of a skull, look into the cranial vault, and you should notice there are basically three bowls. What do we call a bowl in anatomy language? A fossa. Okay, fossa, that's for holding something. Here's the anterior cranial fossa, right? And then here is the middle cranial fossa, and then here's the posterior cranial fossa. All right, so the anterior cranial fossa is partly made up with the frontal bone. So guess what lobes of the brain are held in this anterior cranial fossa? The frontal lobes, okay? And the temporal lobes help make up this middle cranial fossa. Guess what lobes are in here? Those would be the temporal lobes. And then the occipital bone makes up most of the posterior cranial fossa. So that's the occipital lobe of the brain. So that just kind of reiterates how important it is to know bones, because when you know bones, you know a lot of neuroanatomy and muscle anatomy and vascular anatomy and everything else. So it really helps. Okay. All right, so there you got a nice temporal bone. I think we went over a lot of the structures already in lab. What's this one? Sphenoid kind of looks like a bat or a butterfly, right? And you can see the greater wing, lesser wing, and the optic canal would be right about here, for instance. These pterygoid processes. Oh, what's the function of these pterygoid processes? What's the function of a process? Muscle attachment, okay? So, again, by knowing the names of bones, you know there's going to be a muscle attached there, and you could guess what the name of the muscle is. It's that pterygoid muscle, and it's for chewing, as a matter of fact, right? So, you know, sooner or later, it will start making a lot more sense. Okay, there's my favorite bone, ethmoid, right? So here is the perpendicular plate, which makes the superior part of the nasal septum. Here are the paranasal sinuses for fighting infection. Here's the crista galli, which helps anchor your brain in position so it doesn't slosh around inside your cranium. That's really handy. It's got the olfactory foramina so that you can smell. So it does a lot of really interesting jobs for you. Mandible. All right, lower jawbone. All right, so what should you know? Well, the mental foramen right here. All of the alveoli, or the sockets for holding your teeth. This is the body. And then what do we call it when a bone makes a 90-degree turn? That's a ramus, right? So here is the angle, and then this is the ramus of the mandible. And there's another foramen in the what? The medial aspect of the mandibular ramus. And there's a really important nerve as well as blood vessels that go through here. So that's what gives you taste and sensation and motor control of your tongue and your lips, all right? And so that's really important. That's one that has to be anesthetized if somebody's going to be digging around in these teeth right here, for instance. But unfortunately, that's also a nerve that can be damaged really easily if you have a, what do we call these molars back here? Wisdom tooth. Mm-hmm. Okay, if they get impacted, infected, and they're taken out, sometimes a complication is you damage that nerve. And then what happens? You might have paralysis or a loss of taste or sensation on that side of your face. It's really unfortunate when that happens, you know, but it does every once in a while. And it's sometimes not anybody's fault. It just happens. Here's a process, coronoid process. Guess what the function of that is? Muscle attachment, yeah, muscle attachment. Here is a condylar process, because it has a condylar surface, and we call that the mandibular condyle. A condyle participates in a joint. So that part of a bone is going to be moving within another bone, so it should be nice and smooth. And it should have cartilage over it, nice hyaline cartilage. That helps make up what? The TMJ, right? Which we can see in this location over there. So that's a pretty nice picture of a mandible. Maxilla, right? We can see the vomer and ethmoid making up the nasal septum, right? The frontal sinuses, sphenoid sinus. Here's that, a lot of people ask me, where is that incisive fossa or foramen? We can see it right here in the palatine process of the maxilla. Okay, now part of the homework, the pre-reading assignments, I did ask you to tell me what bones make up the orbit. All right, so hopefully you guys are still doing your pre-lecture reading assignments. All right, so I didn't have a key there. Ooh, I better double check that. Something happened. No keys? Whoa. Okay. I'm glad I mentioned it. So you guys got to speak up if they're not popping up. Maybe it's popped up now. I'll see, because we're not really scheduled to go over this until today. I bet it's going to... This morning, but I didn't... I'll double check for sure. Okay. All right. Those are the sinuses. A little funny bone here. Hyoid bone. Check that out on the skeleton. You can't palpate that one. It's completely surrounded by muscle, but very important for articulation, breathing, swallowing, things like that. It's a relatively delicate bone. Okay. That takes us to the vertebral column. And we're going to actually do some of this in lab. Okay. We have the second lab this week on axial skeleton. And we're going to do thoracic cage and vertebrae. So I might as well start talking about it a little bit right now. All right, so the vertebral column is made up of individual bones that we call vertebrae. Okay, and you have a number of vertebrae. They are broken down into different divisions, probably nicely by color. All right, so these we call cervical. Where do we find cervical vertebrae? In your neck. Yeah. Now, did I talk about this already in lab? Oh, I did. Okay, well, I don't want to bore you guys to death. Okay. All right, so we've got to know what? 7, 12, and 5, right? Okay, and how you derived all that. Yeah, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You have some accommodation curvatures, right? Like this posterior curvature in the thoracic region to accommodate organs like lungs and the heart. Accommodation curvature here in the pelvic region to accommodate pelvic organs. Okay, so that's a posterior curvature. You have anterior curvatures, right, in the cervical and lumbar region to redistribute your weight so that it's over the center of your body. Because if all your weight was, okay, way posterior, like due to the thoracic and sacral curvatures, right, if all your weight was posterior, right, you'd have to lean way forward just to stand up straight, just to maintain balance. So these different curvatures then adjust for balance. All right, well, I tell you what is... All right, that's one thing you got to draw, right?
Yeah.
Okay, body, what's this here? Pedicle, lamina, transverse process, spinous process, the vertebral foramen. Where do you have, there's other foramina associated with vertebrae. There's two other locations, which I don't see here. Okay, when you connect two vertebrae together, what do you get? What's that one called? What's that one called when you put a couple together? That's called the intervertebral foramen. That's how nerves can enter and leave the spinal cord. Like here are intervertebral foramen. Right? There's another foramen bilaterally. There are two. Where can you find those at? Not all vertebrae have them, but transverse. Oh, I'm going backwards. Sorry. Yeah. Here. What kind of vertebrae have transverse foramina? Only the cervical vertebrae. Okay, so that's all the ones you got to know. Vertebral foramen, intervertebral foramen, transverse foramen. What's the function of all those? They're passageways. Yep, passageways, right? For blood vessels, nerves, for instance, as well. Right here, C1, otherwise known as?
Atlas.
Good, I went over this in lab already. Nice. So you can distinguish between thoracic and lumbar and cervical vertebrae. That's nice. Okay. The sacrum, let's see what else. Did I go over the ribs?
Yeah.
Maybe, maybe not. Okay, well you got, how many thoracic vertebrae do you have? You got 12. Okay, so that means how many pairs of ribs do you have? 12. It's got to be exactly equal, right? There might be somebody in here with only 11 thoracic vertebrae. So what does that mean for ribs? How many pairs of ribs do you have then? Exactly 11. It's got to match up 1-to-1, right? So the average person or the normal person, if you have 11, it's not really abnormal, but it's kind of rare. The normal person has 12 ribs. The superior 5 are what we call true ribs because they attach to the sternum here via costal cartilage directly. Right, number 1, number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and even 7 goes directly to the sternum. So these are true ribs. But rib number 8, it has costal cartilage, but where does it go? It doesn't go to the sternum. It attaches to the costal cartilage of number 7. So all ribs below 7 are what we call false ribs. Furthermore, the most inferior 2, so that would be 11 and 12, don't have any cartilage whatsoever, so we call those floaters. Right. What else do you have to know? Well, you got to know something about the sternum, like the manubrium here in the body, xiphoid process. It's really important to know something about the xiphoid process because if you're doing CPR, you can break it off, and then it can actually puncture somebody's heart or go into the liver and lacerate the liver, right, and cause a bigger mess. So always chest compressions on the body of the sternum, right? Say body of the sternum. Here's the joint between the manubrium and the body. We call that the sternal angle. And the jugular notch on the manubrium is right smack in the middle. And the clavicular notches, right, are lateral to the jugular notch. All right, so you know what? I think that's pretty much about it, but hopefully I talked about a rib and lab. If I didn't, I'll mention that on Wednesday. Okay, so that's it for tonight. So we'll go over this again in lab. We get to do the skull, I believe, and the vertebral column in lab again. I don't think we go on to appendicular skeleton just yet. But we could if we're getting bored with the axial skeleton. So if you want to look at your tests, either your practicum or your lecture test, let's meet someplace. Who wants to look at your tests? Not very many people. You want to look at the practicum? Fine. Maybe you could follow me down to my office. Good. You could follow me down to my office.